Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. Today we look back at the noughties to see where the great books have been, though Roger Musson from Edinburgh might take us to task for this. There is no necessary reason, he wrote to Saturday Review, why years that happen to share the same first three digits should have anything else in common. Well, yes, Mr. Musson, Philip Larkin would probably agree with you. The Larkin who penned those immortal lines, "Sexual intercourse began in 1963, between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP." His point presumably being that the sexual revolution wasn't, in simple chronological terms, a 60s thing. But oh, how we journalists love to tidy things into lists. Please indulge us. It helps us to deal with the overwhelming volume of stuff there is out there. I, for one, find this particular list fascinating. Isn't it extraordinary, for instance, to think that Zadie Smith and Dave Eggers and Naomi Klein did not exist in the public consciousness in the 20th century? But within 6 months of the 21st, they were well on their way to becoming legends or pariahs, depending on your particular way of looking at things. With me to discuss this and other issues raised by the idea of books of the decade are Sarah Crown, editor of the Books website, and later Sam Jordison, who has spent the autumn curating the Guardian website's very own Worst of the Decade chart. But first, here's what some well-known Guardian writers and editors think.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone and I'm a features writer and interviewer for The Guardian. I think it's been a funny decade in that we've spent most of the time hating America, or at least I have, and yet I've spent most of the time reading its literature and loving it. Right at the beginning of the decade, there was Philip Roth's The Human Stain. I love The Human Stain because, A, it's a great title. B, I love the idea of Nathan Zuckerman, who's the narrator, and the fact that he's an author himself, and he reminds me, as a profile writer, of a profile writer, and creating the most brilliant, complex portraits of characters and turning them into novels. And the books that he feature in, such as The Human Stain, tackle the great issues in America, such as racism in The Human Stain, Vietnam in American Pastoral, and McCarthyism in I Married a Communist. In The Human Stain, it's brilliant because you've got what is basically a good man, an academic, who has told one central lie about his life, and that lie comes to haunt him and to destroy him. That was the beginning of the decade. Towards the end of the decade, I thought Cormac McCarthy was brilliant. He created a sense for me of Bush's America in both The Road and No Country for Old Men. He's created somehow in this sense almost of apocalypse. There's a searing humanity that comes out of it. Everything is devastated in his world. In the film, the most memorable character is the psychopath played by Javier Bardem. But in the book, the main character for me is the sheriff, Tom Bell, and he is someone who's haunted by his past and by a failing that has stayed with him through his life, and he's essentially a good man trying to make up for what he considers is a terrible thing he did as a young man. And it kind of sends a shiver through me even as I think about it. And also, it's a really small book, and I would recommend you to read both of them.
I'm Sarah Bosley. I'm health editor of The Guardian. And my favourite book, I think, of the decade, which takes a lot of thinking about, is Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which absolutely blew me away. It was incredible. It's to do with the poetry of it. It's written in just such an extraordinary way. You can take any little snippet from it, and it's it has massive meaning. It's just very moving. The beauty of the language, but it's also extraordinary story, and the emotion of a father and his connection to his child, which sort of resonates with those of us who've got children very strongly. But I was sort of alarmed slightly when I came to think about these books of the decade, because I noticed that the ones I liked, a lot of them had rather apocalyptic themes. The other one that came to mind was Kazuo Ishiguro, Never Let Me Go. Apart from those two, the other ones that I thought about probably have associations with distant countries and distant conflicts. And actually the kite runner was a very strong contender for me, Khaled Hosseini, and the reluctant fundamentalist, Mohsin Hamid. The kite runner, to me, it opened a window on culture in Afghanistan, as well as talking about the fundamental things about human relationships, relationships between friends in that case, and then the guilt and regret that comes later in adulthood when things have gone wrong. And then the other books that really, I suppose I had been reading a lot in the early part of the decade, were children's books, because I was reading them to my children. Philip Pullman was amazing, so Northern Lights I just couldn't get enough of, really. All three books I thought were absolutely stunning and thought-provoking, and I was amazed that I could share that with my children, that they loved it as much as I did, or the other way around, I'm not sure which.
I'm Lisa Allardyce, I'm the editor of Guardian Review. The early sort of big, noisy novels. I mean, I have great affection for Zadie Smith's White Teeth, which was this sort of buoyant opening to the decade in terms of British fiction, which was, in fact, the first book I ever reviewed, so I have great personal sort of feeling for it. I adore Atonement. I know Ian McEwan's taken a bit of a battering on our blog this week, but I think Atonement is one of the books that you read like a teenager, by which I mean that you totally lose yourself in, as if you were reading a Victorian classic. But I think if I was to say my personal books of the decade, non-fiction would be The Year of Magical Thinking, Joan Didion's memoir of the death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn. And the what turned out to be terminal illness of her daughter. It's a devastating account of grief. I mean, Didion is obviously one of America's classiest prose writers, and here she brings all of the force of her analytical intelligence and descriptive powers to atomizing the experience of grief. And it's stayed with me, as has Carol Shields' novel, Unless. It's a very quiet, very sad story of a mother who's a women's fiction writer. And her daughter goes and sits on a street in Toronto with a sign around her neck that just says, goodness. And I remember it because I think it has one of the most haunting images of unhappiness or grief in the first thing, which it says that unhappiness is like a pane of glass in the mind and you don't realise it all the while you're happy. But you do when it's gone. Anyway, Year of Magical Thinking and Unless.
Hello, I'm Larry Elliott. I'm the Guardian's economics editor. And as you can imagine, I get lots of books sent to me about economics, and most of them are confined straight to the bin because they're deadly boring and I barely give them a second glance. Two that I have particularly enjoyed this decade are Nicholas Taleb's Black Swan, which is about how markets and economies can be fantastically disrupted by seemingly random events, and it takes its title from when explorers went to Australia in the 18th century. They discovered black swans. Up until that point, they'd assumed that all swans were white, and so they were surprised that this seemingly sort of random event had completely altered their view of how the world worked. And that's really how Taleb views economics, that every now and then there are huge unexpected events which sort of blow things completely out of the water. Another economist I've always really admired is Paul Ormerod. His books are sort of fascinating. It takes a sort of completely different take on economics. It gets away from the dry, dusty academic feel. And he had two very good books in the 1990s, The Death of Economics and Butterfly Economics. And he had a very good book in this decade too, which was Why Most Things Fail. I really enjoyed that. That was a fascinating read. But you might be surprised to hear that I do try and read other things other than boring economics books. And the novel I've really, really enjoyed in this decade is Sebastian Barry's The Secret Scripture. I thought that was a lovingly told, beautiful story of a woman who spends most of her life in a mental institution in Ireland. And it sounds, on the face of it, very, very depressing, but it's a very uplifting story of the relationship between a woman and her doctor, with a unexpected twist at the end. And it's not just the fact that it's a riveting read, it's just a beautifully told story. The language is very rich, and the characterization is full, and very humane. I found it both a sympathetic and a very rich read. It was like sort of luxuriating with a glass of port wine. It was just, every page seemed to offer something new and powerful, and that was definitely my book of the decade.
It all goes to show that you can't predict people's taste by their day job. Sarah, is there such a thing as a great book?
Well, I think this is a question that people have been puzzling over for a really long time. And Lisa said there that it's easier to judge the books at the beginning of the decade for their greatness or lack of greatness. And I think it's true that we do need the sort of the lens of time to gain a sense of something's worth, I suppose. Although, you know, people are still arguing over the canon and whether or not books should be in or out of that. So perhaps we never really are all in total agreement. But you can break the idea of greatness down, I think, and say perhaps by great you mean enjoyable or commercially successful or of the moment. There are different ways of sort of measuring them. And I guess that's what the review team did in their review of the books of the decade. The books they chose were chosen on a lot of different criteria.
So they were the books that made an impact in the decade, the 50 books that made the most impact. How else would you end up with Dan Brown on a list?
Yeah, because you have to acknowledge the fact that he was a phenomenon. I mean, his book, The Da Vinci Code, was without question one of the books of the decade. No matter how you sort of draw the Venn diagram of greatness, it was absolutely there in front of us. You couldn't get away from it. Every time you went into a supermarket, you saw another pile of the things. Every time you went into an airport, you were confronted by 50 people reading it. It sort of defined the decade to an extent in literary terms, which is a fairly scary thought.
Then there's a different sort of phenomenological book, Lynn Truss's Eat, Shoots and Leaves. It's when pedantry came into its own.
Yes, and so many people sort of jumped off the back of that. You know, it's developed a huge trend in publishing for not just kind of straight up pedantry like John Humphreys, who went down a similar route, but also things like, I think that this is partly responsible for things like Jeremy Clarkson and his spectacular oeuvre of books, which are all about things that really get your goat, I suppose. And with Lynn Truss, it was, you know, it had a sort of a literary route because she was talking about grammar and the rules of grammar and the way that we abuse them. But Clarkson's kind of taken that and run with it and said, you know, the things that get my goat are people who write for The Guardian, I think, in large part. So, yes, I think she is indirectly a
Clarkson, who is now so important that he's lost his Jeremy entirely.
So I gather, yes, absolutely terrifying.
So then there are books that signalled the arrival of someone of importance. And in among these, one could count White Teeth from 1990, yes. Couldn't one? I mean, the view now seems to be that it is a young book. It's not entirely accomplished.
Yes, which is what Zadie Smith has said about it herself, I think. Again, with that the benefit of distance and a bit of hindsight. It was so vibrant and joyous when it arrived, and everyone was reading it and talking about it. Again, it really felt like it was a turn of the century book. It was, you know, the dawn of the new millennium, this kind of huge sort of colourful collage of people and cast, the urbanness of it and the multiculturalness of it. It felt so sort of necessary, I think. And she's gone on to do lots of other stuff, and some of her best work, I think, is in criticism. But it launched her, and deservedly so, I think.
Mm-hmm. And similarly, Barack Obama, which we chose for our book. In fact, we cheated. That was on nomination for 2008. Although, actually, The Audacity of Hope and Dreams from My Father, neither of them were written in that year.
Yes.
But this has been Obama's decade, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And there's another point that kind of hangs off the back of this, which is a publishing point. Dreams from My Father and The Audacity of Hope were both published by Canongate in the UK, Canongate being one of our sort of most successful independent publishers. And it's also been Canongate's decade to a large extent as well. And they were very savvy with the Obama books because they bought them from the States when he was just a senator, on the grounds of their literary merit. So, you know, how's about that, buying a political book because it's actually really well written? And then, of course, he became the president and they absolutely did brilliantly out of it. And sort of it shows the sort of the thing that independent publishers can do, which mainstream publishers can't, which is take a real punt on something. And they did so well out of it. And it's a good thing to see, I think.
Mm. Now, what about other books that, like Obama's, were actually not written in this particular decade, but have come of age in it? Now, Harry Potter We've nominated Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows for 2007. But actually, nobody would say that's the best Harry Potter book, would they?
No, certainly not. It's probably the third one, I think, was the one that everybody rated most highly. And that
which was The Prisoner of Azkaban, and that was in 1999. Yeah.
But I suppose, it's the thing is that J.K. Rowling, as a brand, and Harry Potter as a brand, were of the first decade of the new millennium. And they also signalled that great trend of the last decade, which was the crossover novel, books that are written sort of ostensibly for children but then are read by adults as well.
So you've got two other ones here, on this list.
Yeah, Philip Pullman obviously also being, certainly technically a better practitioner of that than Rowling.
And again, we've nominated The Amber Spyglass, which is the third and possibly
and again,
not the best
of
the three.
Probably the weakest of the three, yeah.
And another honourable mention goes to The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, Mark Haddon. The most extreme example of books of people that have appeared out of their time is the James Lovelock Gaia books.
Yes, The Adventure of Gaia, yeah.
Because he formulated his series in the 60s,
yes,
didn't he? But he was a crank in those days.
But then he had his moment. The world caught up with him, and so he'll always, I'm sure that he'll always be remembered as an author of the 21st century.
Now, if we're talking somebody who absolutely catches the politics of the time, how about Richard Dawkins? Now, we've got him down as the book of 2006, The God Delusion.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing about this book, I was thinking about this, is that you could almost just have it as a title and not read the book at all. And probably for quite a few people, that's the case. You know, they know it, they feel like they've read it, they know all about it. But it's that title, The God Delusion. It's so pungent. It's so brilliant. He's a great man for titles anyway, Dawkins. He always comes up with a good title. But this one is probably, you know, his finest moment, I'd say. And this was, having been at the end of the 20th century, having felt as if religion was something that we were kind of shaking ourselves free of, suddenly, this century, it's come right back to the fore again, and everyone's talking about it, whether you're talking about kind of Christian fundamentalism in America or Islamic fundamentalism in the Middle East and Pakistan. It's what everyone's talking about, and there have been a rash of books about it. And then you have Dawkins coming out as our sort of premier atheist, absolutely having no track with any of it whatsoever. And all you need to know about this book, I think, and sorry to Richard Dawkins if he's listening, but all you need to know about it is the title. Mm. And it speaks for itself, I think. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, my hunch is that he'll be better known for The Selfish Gene in generations to come.
Yes.
Interesting that he beat off competition, including Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which
I know
a lot of people, in terms of the books that they make them shiver and shudder, that's the one, isn't it, for that year?
No, it's a fantastic book, The Road. It's chilling. I don't know anyone who's read it who hasn't been absolutely kind of frozen for a couple of days afterwards.
Now, to leave the sport of lists behind, one of the things the noughties have been remarkable for is the growth of poetry and performance at a time when everybody said poetry was doomed. Here's Fiona Shaw reading T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland in a performance directed by Deborah Warner, which had its first outing way back in 1995.
My nerves are bad tonight. Yes. Bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What? Thinking what? I never know what you are thinking. Think. I think we are in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones. What is that noise? The wind under the door. What is that noise now? What is the wind doing? Nothing. Again, nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? I remember those are pearls that were his eyes.
Fiona Shaw in The Wasteland, which will be at London's Wilton's Music Hall from December the 30th to January the 10th. Sarah, performance poetry doesn't usually mean reading a poem that was written in 1922, does it?
Not normally, no. It tends to be poets reading work that they've just written.
But none of these poets figure on any of the books of the decade, do they?
No. Well, it's been an interesting decade for poetry. I think particularly for spoken poetry and one person who has a lot of responsibility for that is Andrew Motion, who during his tenure as the Poet Laureate set up this website called the Poetry Archive. And the idea of it was to record the many, many contemporary poets reading their poetry so that we'd have this huge database of poets reading. And it also has sort of ancient recordings of, you know, it has Yeats there reading in it. I mean, it's fantastic. And anyone who doesn't know it should go and visit it straight away. But that was one of the great things in poetry in the last decade, I think, was setting this up. And one of Motion's great successes in his time in the laureateship. But it's also, it seems to me that it, was bound up with a move more generally to get people reading their poetry again. Instead of seeing poetry as words on a page, it's seeing it as a spoken form, as an art. And some of my best poetry experiences of the decade have been going to listen to poets reading their work in, you know, sort of sitting in a dark room and watching somebody in a spotlight, and, you know, when the rest of the world just fades away and you're just there with the words and the person, and it's absolutely wonderful. There's nothing like it, I think.
Do you have any particular people that people should be looking out for?
Well, it's interesting. I go and listen to quite a lot of poetry, and it's not always the poets who you think are, you know, the great poets on the page who come up as the greatest poets in their reading. But one person who I think does both of those things for me is Alice Oswald. She's somebody who's quite difficult to get to see her, because she spends a lot of time doing her day job, which is being a gardener down in Devon. And so she very rarely comes out to read. But if you ever see her on a bill, or, you know, she should be up for the T.S. Eliot readings, as she's shortlisted for that in January. Just go. If you can get a ticket, go, because she just reads so beautifully, and she looks out into the distance, and she's got quite a light voice, and it's a wonderful thing to listen to. So do that.
Another of my favourites is Lem Sisse, I think.
He's got
such a great way of reaching out, particularly to young audiences.
Yes. And he was poet in residence, wasn't he, at the South Bank Centre for the Literature Festival. And I think he's done a lot of really good work in that area.
Do you think that there's something particular about the noughties bringing live events to the fore? Why has that happened?
I suspect that it has happened in large part because of marketing departments. Because I think what happened in publishers is that they saw that the people always up to this point who were out reading their work and publicising their work in that way with live readings was children's authors, because kids absolutely love to meet the people who've written their books. And there's a real fascination there with the idea of the author, which we're all sort of trained out of at university. And what happened there was that children's authors were out in the schools reading to small audiences, because that was, you know, they were paid to do it, and it's a great way to sort of get kids into their books. And then the publicity departments of publishers realised that this actually worked. And people, if you hear somebody read from their book, you're much more likely to buy it afterwards. So that, I think then what happened was they marshalled their forces and sent their authors out around the country going to readings. And what we've seen this decade, a really noticeable thing on the literary landscape, has been the absolute explosion of book festivals around the country. You can't go through a town without seeing a book festival. You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous. In the summer months, you literally can't turn around. And I use the word literally advisedly. but yeah, so I think it has. It's been a huge change.
One of the advantages to authors is that if you actually see them performing, it's very hard to dislike them,
yes,
which may well be a point to bear in mind when we come to the worst books of the year, as curated by Sam Jordison for the Guardian Books website. We invited Sam into the studio to analyse the results.
For a start, it's much easier and probably funnier to slag things off and have a dig. And, you know, hate is much easier to access for an awful lot of online personalities, I think. But I think there's one of the things that has consistently come up is it's a reaction against what they see as the clubbiness of the book world, and the fact that one of their principal targets has been Ian McEwan, for instance, who no one seems to dare to even criticise. And they see a conspiracy, I think, of fellow novelists. So, for instance, if you were an up-and-coming novelist writing a review, perhaps criticising Ian McEwan would be a form of career suicide. I don't mean to imply that he's in any way tyrannical, but, you know, as the premier novelist in the country, who's also very influential, big links with UEA, for instance.
Do you think this is fair, Sarah? I know it's one thing to say that this is the perception. Is the perception fair?
There is a bit of truth in it, and that it's partly a sort of, you know, kind of conspiracy theory area. So, for example, you look at the reviews of Saturday, which is the book that came up over and over again in this list of worst books of the decade, and pretty much, with the exception of John Banville, who absolutely tore it to shreds in the US, everyone was very positive about it. We were positive about it. But then, I mean, this is sort of slightly anecdotally, but, you know, with the backing of the list itself, everyone on the list who sort of brought it up as an example of a bad book didn't like it. And so there is an absolute disjunction between those two things. And it's not that the book was without quality, and I don't really think it was one of the worst books of the decade. I think that's probably, in fact, massively overstating the case. But you can see that there are certain authors who
it's difficult, I guess, to criticise. And that's an interesting and slightly dangerous.
Well, I'm now going to come in and defend Saturday because at the time I was very disturbed by it, as an awful lot of my friends were. We used to, you know, you'd get people phoning up. It's almost unheard of. People would phone up and say, what did you think of it? What did you think?
It really
of
was. It was a real talking point at
the
time.
It was very buzzy. And I think that was what it did was it conducted the electricity that was in the atmosphere. And you're talking about a time which was, you know, before Hurricane Katrina and after 9/11, what everybody was looking for was the sort of civilized male voice. And it got incredibly claustrophobic and overheating. It overheated. A lot of us sort of felt it, but we couldn't articulate it. And this book articulated that smugness, which in retrospect on a second reading, I thought was actually fascinating and was actually in the mark of a successful work of fiction. So there you are. There's my defense. There is an element of books that hit their time almost too precisely, isn't there? Like Giles Foden's Zanzibar, which happened just after the 9/11 bombings, or Chris Cleeve's Incendiary.
Yes.
Both of which, you know, actually were too topical. They were too sore at the moment.
But then you look at something like Philip Roth and The Plot Against America, which, again, was very much, very timely and very sort of, although it was a sort of historical take on the American election, I suppose, and the things that could go wrong after it. Although it had a very weak ending, and that sort of generally has been accepted that, you know, it was rushed out and so the ending didn't really quite hang together. But the book itself, even at the time, I thought was fantastic and, you know, absolutely gripping, sort of vintage Roth, really.
There's no prizes for guessing which was the worst book of the decade, according to our books blog community. Do we have runners-up?
We do. D.V.C. Pierre's Vernon Godlittle featured very highly. And I quite enjoyed Vernon Godlittle, but I can understand that it got such an intense negative reaction because while it's a good book, does it really deserve to win the Booker Prize? And why is it more worthy than, say...
But it's not its fault that it won the Booker Prize. No. This is something that always gets to me. It's a poor author, just goes, does their best, wins a prize, and everybody lays into them.
Well, this is what happens to Zadie Smith as well, who always crops up in these lists, who hasn't really done anything wrong except being extremely sellable in the media through being good-looking and very eloquent, as well as a good writer, and in a sense she's almost become a victim of that. And people really resent her, even though her output is, you know, perfectly acceptable.
There's also the thing of we were talking about this slightly before we began, of the thing where you Sam said that it was sort of like a backhanded compliment in a way, because what it means to appear on this list is that everybody has read your book, and so there's always going to be a correlation between the most read books list and the worst books list, because if you have, you know, a chunk of people reading your book, then more people are going to dislike it, just by the law of averages, I suppose.
It's a bit like winning a bad sex award.
Yeah.
You have to take it like a man. Dan Brown.
Yes.
Also figures on this
list. Yeah, and he was one of the few writers who you would say has written a pretty genuinely bad book. Although there were defences of Dan Brown on the grounds that it is incredibly, you know, addictive reading and he's very good at page showing, but, you know, his prose is pretty workmanlike.
Was there
best,
a lot of disagreement among the various the individual posters? Did they squabble about their taste?
They did a bit, and Dan Brown was one of the ones that they squabbled about, because an awful lot of people came on and said how terrible it is and tore apart his sentences and, you know, said things like, if Dan Brown was forbidden to use the word then, he wouldn't have been able to write a single paragraph. But other people came on and said, well, yeah, but he's not there to impress with his prose. He's just there to weave a story and keep you going. And to that extent, he's a success. So he's definitely one of the people squabbled at. Ian McEwan, again, he did have a few defenders.
And you can't argue with, you know, the elegance of his prose. I think, yeah, in Saturday, it was just perhaps the subject matter, really.
There were some surprises, weren't there? I mean, I was absolutely astonished to find that Rorschach texts featured. Now, this is a first book by Stephen Hall. Why on earth would people take so violently against this?
I don't know. It was quite a strange one. I think the thing they particularly focused in on was the final section, the reenactment of Jaws, which seemed to really irritate a lot of people. Why they wondered why they were reading something they've already seen in the film, and they thought it was a gimmick. And went on for far too long was the other thing they said. So I think it's one particular part of the book that had annoyed them. And it's this other thing when we're talking about backhanded compliments, I think it's because they expected so much more by that stage, because it is quite an impressive book.
So Sarah, do you think it's partly about the hype that had built up around, they're reviewing the hype rather than the book itself?
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, with the Rorschach text, I liked it a lot. I thought it was a really good book. But before I read it, I was pretty much inclined to not like it, because there was so much hype, you know, that its publisher had sort of Canongate had pushed it so heavily. So you're sort of bristling a bit by that point, you know. There's a slight sense of being told what to like. And I thought it stood up really well. I thought it was a great book and it was worth the hype. But I can see how other people who didn't like it for whatever reason would feel more let down than you would do if you just picked up any old book.
Mm. You're a bit of a softie yourself, aren't you? You're not just a hater. Give me a couple of your books of the decade, just to finish off with.
One that's really going to stick with me is My Elvis Blackout by Simon Crump, which is fantastically funny and unlike anything else I've ever read. And it made me go to Graceland, for instance, even though it's a completely fictional account of Elvis, it made me fall in love with Elvis all over again. And so it's this weird combination. It's terrifically hateful and spiteful, and there's a really funny passage where he's incredibly cruel to a fictional version of Christa Burr, for instance. But underneath all this, it's really affectionate. So even though he's portraying this terrible world of a psychopathic, murderous Elvis, there's also real love for Elvis and affection. So it ends up being extremely sweet and touching. So I think that really moved me.
So there you are, Sam Jordison, the enthusiast. We've outed him on the Guardian Books podcast. Sarah, I put Sam on the spot there. How about you? Just to be fair, what's your book of the decade?
Well, would you let me choose three if I choose them from different genres?
Oh, go on then.
I think my sort of first book of the decade, and the first book that I fell in love with this decade, and one that's really stayed with me, that I've bought for everyone I know, is Lorna Sage's memoir of her family life and adolescence, Bad Blood. I heard about it on Radio 4. I was listening to a programme on Radio 4, and I think she herself came on, actually, this was just before she died, and was talking about it, and I was cleaning my bedroom and I stopped in my tracks to listen to this and thought, God, that sounds like a good book. And I went out and bought it, and it was just absolutely stunning. And it also, I think, kickstarted what was another trend of the decade, which was the sort of the personal memoir rather than a memoir of somebody who's famous for something. Sage was a literary critic, really, but she picked her book, she picked her life apart as she picked books apart and read it back to us, and I thought it was just amazing, just a beautiful book. And then in short fiction, the book that I'd like to choose is Alice Munro's collection, Runaway. We've talked a lot about Alice Munro recently, both on the podcast and on the book's website, because she won the International Man Booker Prize for her body of work this year. And Runaway, I think, is my favourite of her short story collections. It has a series of linked stories in it, which feature the same characters at different points in their lives. She has this spare, stark, incredibly incisive way of writing about people's small town lives and of the countryside around her, where she lives in Canada. And I think there's nobody really writing quite like she is at the moment in the world, probably. And then in poetry, the only poetry book that made it onto the Guardian's list of books of the decade was Don Patterson's Landing Light, and there's a reason for that, and the reason is that it's absolutely brilliant. I think it's the book of poetry that really defined the decade for poetry. It won the T.S. Eliot Prize when it came out, and for me, I think he's the Larkin of our decade, Don Patterson. He's able to be so deeply personal in his poems and also incredibly liquidly musical in his writing. And I don't think there's anybody writing in poetry in the UK quite like him at the minute. So those would be my three.
Mine? Well, I'm also going to cheat and choose three. But in my case, there's more excuse to do so because it's a trilogy. It's Gerard Woodward's Jones Family trilogy, August, I'll Go to Bed at Noon and A Curious Earth, which I was appalled to see. You got a mention on Worst Books of the Decade, but we'll forget about that. It seemed to me to capture a particular wooziness of alcoholism in the family. And of course, alcoholism in the family is such a big theme now. It seemed to have everything to me. Wooziness of a different sort infuses the poetry we are ending this podcast with. It's The Shut-In from Don Patterson's Landing Light, one of the books of the decade for 2007 and Sarah's personal favourite.
The Shut-In by Don Patterson. Good of them, all told, to leave me locked inside my favourite hour. The whole one early, I came to wait for one I loved too dearly, in this coffered snug below the viaduct, with my dark vernacular ale, Stevenson's short fiction, and the little game I played of not thinking of her, except to thumb away the exquisite stitch that gathers at my breastbone. The minute hand strains at its lengthening tether, like Achilles on the hair. The luscious beer refills, the millionth page flowers on the last of the bottled imp. Oh, fathers, leave me here, beyond the night, the stars, beyond the vast, infinitesimal letdown of each other.
That's all for our review of 2009. Thanks to Sam Jordison, Sarah Crown and Chris Moran for that moving reading. That's all for our review of books of the decade and indeed our podcasting for the decade. Thanks to Sam Jordison, Sarah Crown and Chris Moran for that moving reading. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with our preview of 2010, in which we'll be asking the booksellers Benedicta Page and our own Michael White to find their way through the literature of election year. I'm Claire Armistead and the programme was produced by Scott Corley. From all of us on the books team, happy Christmas.